63. This is Illinois Public Media WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, June 7th, 2009. Today we have as our guest someone who probably needs no introduction to just about anyone in our listening audience, Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, lifelong advocate for environmental, workplace, consumer, public interest standards, here to join us for the full hour live on Media Matters, so it should be a wonderful program. Before we go to Ralph Nader, though, let's go first, as we do every week, to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
President Barack Obama's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act included $7.2 billion to expand broadband services in unserved and underserved areas. The National Telecommunications Information Administration and the Rural Utilities Service are tasked with funding projects that will bridge the digital divide, which could include municipal broadband systems. Esme Voss is an intellectual property lawyer, business owner, and founder of the website MuniWireless.com, which has chronicled the highs and lows of municipal broadband projects since 2003. Voss says that communities that have done a good job planning their networks will have a better chance at getting funded.
They need to have done basically equipment costs and how much they're going to charge the residents, and then they should have done some kind of business plan, so they have to have some idea of the annual operating cost of the network.
Voss says that some areas are too small to generate enough revenue to cover their operating costs. She says counties are coming together to pool resources and share funding. She suggests regional networks as another solution.
You get together and say, look, we're going to band together and put out one RFP, or we're going to do a survey together and we're going to put it out to bid, and then we'll buy everything together, and that way we can also link our networks so that it's not just these silos of networks, but that all these networks actually get linked.
Voss would like to see high-speed fiber optic broadband everywhere. But for some areas, getting fiber to each household is impractical, and rollout for underserved urban areas could be years away. She suggests that wireless services connected to a main fiber line can be employed to get individual buildings connected.
You can't do it fast enough, and people need broadband now. They needed it yesterday. So wireless, you know, this mix of WiMAX and Wi-Fi is absolutely the best, cheapest, fastest way to bring broadband to areas that do not have it today.
Voss says so-called net neutrality rules are important for any build-out.
The reason why we need certain rules in place is you want to make sure that whoever is getting government money to give broadband service to people doesn't pick and choose between applications that could compete with what he's offering. That's not good, because then you get a monopoly. There's a very basic freedom of speech issue there when the pipe and the applications that go through the pipe are controlled by one company.
Every time you hear a song played on the radio, royalties are paid to the composer and publisher, but the performers don't see a penny. That could be changing. The Performance Rights Act, H.R. 848, was introduced in Congress by Representative John Conyers of Michigan. The bill would require radio stations to compensate performers and record labels when their songs are played. Paul Porter, co-founder of Industry Ears, has been involved in the broadcasting industry for more than 20 years. Porter explains that the legislation is long overdue and that artists and performers should also financially benefit from the radio airplay they receive.
In the past, it hasn't happened. Publishers who write songs, they get credit from BMI and ASCAP, and for a long time, it's been necessary that performers get paid, and it happens in 30 other countries, and it doesn't happen here.
The bill has passed out of one House committee already, but it is controversial. broadcasters want to continue their exemption from paying a performance royalty, and they've been lobbying heavily against it, putting up ads across Washington and taking to the airwaves to rally opposition.
It's just amazing to me how the issues change from artists being paid to radio stations surviving. To me, the right thing to do is, you know, they've made stations so music intensive. That's their goal. So why shouldn't the artists be paid? That's how they garner their ratings.
Broadcasters have stepped up their attacks against the bill, claiming performance royalties will put already struggling radio stations with plunging revenues out of business. Others say the increased royalties will further narrow radio playlists. But Porter says that in many ways, the radio industry is its own worst enemy.
Radio's gone from serving local listeners to stockholders. And that's the real bad thing about it. Once it went corporate, you know, the only way to save a buck is cutting out services.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. It's a great pleasure to be here today. We have a guest we've been wanting to have for a long time. We're very fortunate to have him. He is a guest I think will need no introduction to our listening audience. Ralph Nader is probably the most important consumer advocate of the past century in American history. His list of accomplishments would take literally the entire program to go through. Let's just leave it at this, that in 1990, Life magazine named Nader as one of the 100 most influential Americans of the 20th century. And at NYU, a panel of journalists accorded his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, to be the 38th most important work of journalism of the 20th century. He's probably best known to many of our younger listeners as a frequent candidate for U.S. president, but he's still at this point an extraordinarily active consumer advocate. Ralph Nader, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much.
Ralph, let's get right down to business and talk, if we can, about the General Motors situation. What's going on there? Your assessment of what's going on there, what should be done and what is being done?
Well, if we start with the status of General Motors, highly mismanaged for years as a declining company heading for dissolution, if we don't go into all that history of bad cars and bad service and lack of innovation and stagnant management, and just start with the issue confronting the Obama administration, which is what do you do with the GM sub-economy that involves thousands of dealers and suppliers and hundreds of communities and hundreds of thousands of workers directly and indirectly around the country. And I think it was handled badly. It was handled as if it was a bankruptcy remedy when it shouldn't have been, because the public policy issues were far greater than the charge that Obama gave to the task force that represented him in dealing with General Motors, headed by Steve Rattner and other Wall Streeters who didn't know much and don't know much about the auto manufacturing process. So I disagreed very much with that approach, because I thought it was a congressional responsibility, first and foremost. In 1979, Chrysler was bailed out after deep congressional hearings and deliberation through legislation. Turned out very well for the taxpayer, who made $400 million on the Treasury Department's ownership of warrants, which were sold after Iacocca turned Chrysler around. Not long after that, Congress deliberated with public hearings the complex restructuring of Conrail, the railroad entity, and legislated. But now Congress seems to escape its responsibilities on a weekly basis, not only foreign and military policy, such as the war in Iraq, but also in dealing with the auto industry. So what happened was, after a few hearings last year and earlier this year, where Congress members of Congress berated General Motor executives for coming to the hearing in corporate jets, et cetera, it washed its hands of it and sent it basically to the White House, and Obama gave it to the task force, which operates in secret and isn't accountable. Now, what
should have been done and what partially can still be done is for Congress to reassert responsibility for the Chrysler and General Motors situations and stop this policy by secret fiat. And Chrysler, it actually is almost ironic. It was the fiat from the White House to the Auto Task Force, then the fiat from the Auto Task Force to Chrysler, and then selling Chrysler, or a big portion of it, to Fiat in Italy. With General Motors, it's bankruptcy court in New York. Now, most people, Bob, don't know that Chapter 11 corporate bankruptcy is a kangaroo court. It is very rare that anybody but corporate management gets affirmative decisions by the bankruptcy judge, and that's exactly what's been happening in the Chrysler and GM bankruptcy. So that people who have claims as injured people, who have product liability claims against GM and Chrysler, they've been wiped out. They don't really have any standing in bankruptcy court other than to get whatever crumbs the bankruptcy judge decides to give out. So their day in court has been wiped out. Their trial by jury has been wiped out. The dealers have, many thousands of them are being closed, even though dealers don't cost auto manufacturers next to nothing. And, of course, the suppliers are now heading for bankruptcy. So this is not a good situation. It's a very autocratic, pro-management, in this case, pro-Obama Task Force bankruptcy court that's going to unleash a Death Star when it ends in a few weeks that will damage or destroy hundreds of thousands of jobs, thousands of small businesses, and hundreds of depleted communities around the country. So I've just written an article for Barron's, Bloomberg, which will be out tomorrow, arguing that it has to go back to Congress. And Congress has to deal with many, many public policy questions, such as GM's move to China with taxpayer subsidies, such as the claimants under product liability, and such as the dealer issues. Those are not going to be dealt with in bankruptcy court.
Ralph Nader, our guest here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number 333-9455 here at WILL AM 580. Our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Ralph Nader, I don't know if you saw it, but within the past week, Michael Moore had an article that got a lot of attention on the web and did a series of interviews. And he argued that, you know, the United States government should go all the way, take over General Motors, and instead of just trying to have it compete with producing traditional automobiles, it should use its leverage to really use General Motors to drive forward the green economy and to really create a new type of manufacturing and sort of lead the market rather than follow it. What do you think of that argument?
A big opportunity. First of all, the government's putting at least $50 billion taxpayer dollars into GM. That entails some responsibility by the Obama administration. He just can't say, well, I'm not going to run GM. I can't wait to get out of the shareholder ownership situation. They've crossed that Rubicon. It's too late. It is now essentially a politicized process. And that means that since the U.S. government has statutory missions that are being opposed year after year, environmental missions, fuel efficiency missions, auto safety missions, etc., this is a great opportunity. When the government is owning 60% of GM, the Canadian government is owning 12.5%, that is massive control. And with ownership should go control. And now the government is the biggest insurance policy for GM. It's the biggest subsidizer for GM. It's the biggest lender for GM. And now it's the biggest shareholder. So what are we waiting for? After 40 years of stubborn opposition to federal fuel efficiency, safety, and emission control regulations, the government can simply say, we own you, and this is what you're going to do. Now it's going to take smart auto manufacturing types to replace the existing GM management, people who combine knowledge with the desire for innovation. They're around. They're often in auto supply companies. Some of them are now farmed out to universities. Some of them are retired but still very able. So it just can't be a policy move on GM. It's got to be also very smart people who know how to turn around a giant auto company that still has thousands of dealers, tens of thousands of skilled people, and hundreds of very smart engineers and scientists. So that's what it needs to be done, but it won't be done. It is the opportunity of a lifetime. Those of us who have worked to try to get GM, this elephant, turned around a bit, could only dream of the situation that Obama now has in his hands as a trustee for the American taxpayer, who are people who buy cars and get hurt in cars and have to pay for inefficient fuel cars, et cetera. And it doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Ralph Nader, do you think, to take up the argument I oftentimes hear from people, do you think that the United States just simply can't have high-wage manufacturing anymore? Either all manufacturing has to more or less shift to low-wage, heavy labor populations like India and China, or what manufacturing we have has to either be so super specialized it won't employ very many people, or will have to simply be low-wage, non-labor jobs in order to compete with global markets?
Well, why do we want to compete with global markets? That's a question that's almost heresy. We have 310 million people in this country. if there was no one else in the world, we'd have a pretty self-sufficient marketplace. And so we really have to ask ourselves the following. The amount of labor that goes into building cars now, in terms of the price that it costs an auto company, is very low. It's about 10% of GM manufacturing plants go to labor costs. Number two, regardless of where these plants are in the world, whether they're in serf labor countries like China or here, it's still the same capital equipment. In other words, highly automated robotic manufacturing processes. So there's an equal playing field there. And third, what are we doing subsidizing with tax dollars the shipment of GM and Chrysler factories to dictatorships and oligarchies who do not allow independent trade unions, who do not allow access to the courts, who do not allow adequate regulation, who fester in bribery? Those should be considered unlawful, unfair methods of competition against U.S. workers and U.S. businesses under any kind of rational trade rules, but they're not. And so we have allowed dictatorships and oligarchies to invite our companies abroad and leave hollowed communities and unemployed workers and their families behind, and using their dictatorial control over costs. Labor costs in China are dictatorially determined, not by collective bargaining or independent unions. Those are outlawed. To drag down our economy. Now, what kind of political leadership in Washington would continue to allow this to happen, continue to use taxpayer dollars to subsidize them, and continue to mislead the American people that these bailouts are really about preserving jobs in this country? Kenosha, Wisconsin, Chrysler, up-to-date engine plant, award-winning, was told that the plant would continue operating just before Chrysler went bankrupt a few weeks ago. Mr. Nardelli actually called the plant manager and the workers and told them so. Right after Chrysler went into voluntary bankruptcy in New York City, he had to call up and say he made a mistake. The plant with its 800 workers will be closed down and most of it will be shipped to Mexico, leading one worker to say, "What's going on here? We were told the government money is going to be used to save the industry. That's good. We like that. And now we're told our tax dollars are being used to ship our jobs to foreign countries." Now, you would think, Bob, that there would be a real rumble out there among labor unions, among workers in and outside the auto industry, or just among ordinary taxpayers. We are living in a period of American history that combines government paralysis with civic abdication or resignation or whatever you want to call the lack of activity. But the moment the Obama administration settled with the UAW and GM, that took away the main force in Washington. And what the UAW got was what they've been getting for 15 years, dwindling number of jobs in return for job security for the remaining workers behind. They've lost 80% of their workers in the last 27 years. So once that they were co-opted into this deal, and they thought, you know, maybe that's the best thing they could have gotten, a main power broker within the Democratic Party managed to say to the Democrats in the last few weeks on Capitol Hill, don't make any objection, just watch it. We're in delegate negotiations, and don't do anything. And that is going to be a disaster for what's left of the GM sub-economy around the country.
Our guest today, Ralph Nader on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Ralph, I want to go into the financial bailout there. But before we go into that, just real quickly, what is your assessment of where our economy broadly, our macroeconomy, is today by historical standards? Are we in a normal recession, a traditional recession like we had in the early 90s and the early 80s and the early 70s and the late 50s? Or are we in something more pronounced, more severe?
I think we're in for a long period of stagnation, whether you call it recession or mild depression. It'll have its little ups and downs. But right now, you can see the financial observers, their favorite phrase is less than expected. So in the last few weeks, if they expect 650,000 jobs lost, and the report comes in less, hey, things are not getting worse. They're not exactly turning around. But I think the basic problem, Bob, is that our economy has evolved heavily into a financial paper economy, so that a lot of the wealth that's produced out of Wall Street and out of the financial services is paper wealth. It's making money from money. Whenever you have a big portion of the economy making money from money, very few people make most of the money, and it's very concentrated. But it's not real wealth. It's not like you're producing real important things like public transit vehicles, like health services for those who are denied them, like housing for those who need them. So there are two economies side by side, the paper economy that I just described and the real economy that focuses on meeting the needs and wants of more and more people. And it's the paper economy that's cannibalized the real economy. It's the paper economy that took trillions of dollars of real pension workers' money and real mutual fund savings and squandered it through spectacular, risky, speculative instruments called derivatives. As these financial bosses in Wall Street paid themselves enormous sums, squandered other people's money, jumped ship with a golden parachute, and then had the ship go to Washington for a weekend or secretive bailout after bailout by the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve. So this is what Sidney Wollin called in his great book, Democracy, Inc. He would be a great interview, Professor Emeritus from Princeton. And this is what he called inverted totalitarianism. And that's what's going on in this country, with more and more decisions being made by fewer and fewer people in the context of a corporate state, that is, a government controlled by corporate power. 1938, Franklin Delano Roosevelt worried about this during the Depression, and he sent a message to Congress urging the creation of an investigative commission, which Congress enacted, called the TNEC, Temporary National Economic Commission. And in his introductory message to the bill that he sent to Congress, he said, almost paraphrased accurately, whenever government is controlled by private economic power, that's fascism. No, those are the UZ words. That's fascism. That's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So we're in a very serious political situation that is continually undermining the economic situation in our country. And our statistics are often sugar-coated. We're told that unemployment is 9.4%, but actually it's closer to 15%. Why? Because if you stop looking for a job in the United States after 6 months, you're not considered unemployed, even though you are. And if you are in a part-time job, because you can't get a full-time job, where you work under 20 hours a week, you're not considered. As long as you work 20 hours a week, you're considered employed. Well, you know, that's not really a sustaining job at that level. But there are a lot of workers who are at that level. So we need to mobilize people as citizens. They've got to take the reins of their country. That means they've got to spend time. They've got to create their own media. They've got to make sure the media becomes much more accountable and decentralized, as you've studied and written books about for years, Bob. And they've got to stop thinking that personal freedom is civic freedom. Yeah, they can choose their own friends, buy their own records and music, and decide what kind of food they're going to eat and decide what trips they're going to take. That's personal freedom. That's not civic freedom. Is being part of a democratic process as people that participates in power and shapes the decisions of the country.
Our guest, Ralph Nader. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line 4, Coles County. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Yes, two things very quickly. First of all, I heard Mr. Nader speak at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, Illinois, just after Reagan's election in 1980. And it was a tremendous speech. I've heard many, many speeches by John F. Kennedy and many other people in person. But it was the greatest speech I've ever heard. He was a tremendous, tremendous speaker. Number two, very quickly, I'm hoping that we have a national health plan, a single-payer plan. But in my opinion, the prospects don't look too good for congressional passage of a single-payer health plan. I'm wondering whether he believes there is any chance or what the chances are of congressional passage of a single-payer plan within the next few years. I think that's it.
Thank you very much, caller. Ralph Nader?
Well, the majority of people, majority doctors, majority nurses want single-payer, which is another word for full Medicare for everybody, everybody in, nobody out, replacing the health insurance companies like Aetna, which is essentially what Medicare did in the mid-60s when it was instituted for elderly people, although there is a Medicare gap that the insurance companies went into. The problem is that so many people who want single payer, including, by the way, Hillary Clinton, she said that years ago. Barack Obama said he was starting from scratch, he'd be single payer. Kennedy, single payer. I mean, most Democrats, single payer. But as long as they sing the same song, that it's not possible, it's not practical, guess what? It's not going to happen. So there's a belief gap here. There's a determination gap that needs to be overcome. It turns out that single payer is far more efficient. It replaces $350 billion, give or take, of administrative costs that are incurred by the health insurance company bureaucracies. It is much more humane. 20,000 people a year, at least, die every year in this country because they can't afford health insurance. Nobody dies in Germany, France, Sweden, Canada because they can't afford health insurance. They're insured from the moment they're born. So it's a much more humane system. And number three, it allows doctors to practice medicine instead of bookkeeping or collection masters. And number four, it gets rid of a lot of billing fraud, which doesn't get much attention. The General Accounting Office, 1992, which has been confirmed since, concluded that 10 cents out of every healthcare dollar that's spent in this country goes down the drain due to complex billing fraud and abuse. You know, these are the bills that you can hardly understand because they're all in code. Well, manipulating codes manipulates the size of the bill. And that's $230 to $250 billion there. So we have a lot of waste, a lot of corruption, a lot of ripoffs that can be squeezed out with a single-payer system, which must be associated with quality and cost control. You simply can't say to an American citizen that tax-subsidized drug companies who offer Taxol, like Bristol-Myers Squibb, for thousands and thousands of dollars for six treatments for, say, ovarian cancer, can continue doing that. not when the drug was discovered with taxpayer money by the National Cancer Institute, and not when it was tested with taxpayer money and then given free to Bristol-Myers Squibb. So there is a very good website, singlepayeraction.org, that I want to bring to your attention, to your listeners.
Thank you, Ralph.
It started just a few weeks ago, and it's been picking up big steam. If you've been hearing anything written that single payer is coming back on the table, at least, instead of being ignored by Senator Baucus and others, it's because this website has moved into direct action, demonstrations, standing up in congressional hearings and asking the question, why aren't any of these witnesses single payer advocates, Senator? And now the papers are reporting that all these meetings that Obama is promoting among citizens to discuss health care, the single payer questioners in the audience are dominant. They're the ones who are asking the tough questions, showing up in one meeting around the country. So I hope those of you who are interested would visit singlepayeraction.org. You'll see actually the video of the celebrated stand-up in the Senate Finance Committee hearing by doctors. This is a rebellion that's going to be led by doctors and nurses.
Our guest again, Ralph Nader, who you've been listening to here on Media Matters. Our phone number, WILLAM580-333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Coming to you live, I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Let's go back to the phone lines right now for our next caller. Line 1, Decatur, you're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Yes, good afternoon. It's an honor to be on the program with you. I have another log to throw on fire. I see this economic mild depression we're in as the first leg down in an implosion of our economic society, the way we see it. Anyway, if I were king, I think I would start asking the railroads, how much more rail do you need to go, let's say, if you've got a single track to Chicago, you go double track and then double track to triple track. How much rail do you need? And buy the steel and the concrete right now and stockpile it while it's cheap. And then that can boost our economy later on as we have to move to mass transit over the rail and then later to electrify the lines. And I'll hang up and take your comments off the line.
Well, thank you very much, caller Ralph.
Well, I'm a big promoter of railroads and modern public transit, and I emphasize modern because the available practical technology in mass transit is spectacular. Don't think of it as old snorting buses and rundown trains. And if we ever need a jobs program like we do now in this country, what better jobs program than beginning to replace highway congestion with all its environmental and accident and time delays with very efficient networks of public transit and inner-city railroads. I know it's going to take a change in habits, but more and more people are fed up. One of the reasons people are leaving California is because of Southern California traffic congestion. They're fed up with this. They don't want to spend the equivalent of a month and a half a year going back and forth from work in terms of hours. So I'm all for that. Now, unfortunately, the Obama administration, in the stimulus package, hundreds of millions of dollars, as we know, didn't allocate that much for railroads. I think it was like $8 billion, which would pay for a bullet train on the East Coast or West Coast, hardly. It's got to expand that. And I think there's still room to shift around where those hundreds of billions of dollars are going. And Congress should really begin in the effervescence of passing it a few weeks ago just to get something done to help turn the economy around a bit. They didn't work on the allocations within the hundreds of millions of dollars as they should.
Ralph Nader, before we go to our next caller, I want to get to a point you've mentioned, sort of alluded to earlier, and that really is a signature of your work for decades now, which is sort of coming to terms with corporate power and the role corporations play in our economy and in our politics and what we can do about it. And maybe just for some of our listeners who haven't really heard a lot about this, it's not a theme you hear much on the news media. Talk a little bit about what corporate power means, what the problems are with it, and in general, what sort of political steps can we take to address it as a problem?
Well, the liberals had a Washington Hilton conference. They have it every year. It just ended last week, run by Rob Borsage. And the description of it was that attendance was down very severely from 3,000 to 1,500 or so, and that there wasn't much spark. It's like, oh, you know, we got Obama in the White House. And what's, you know, what can we do? What can be done is to focus on corporate reform. The corporate power in this country is the central power juggernaut that is deciding and planning, deciding so many things for people and planning their future. Corporations are planning our political future. We know that. They're into all the campaign finance and all the selecting of candidates and lobbies in Washington. They're planning our economic future. They're planning our environmental future by opposing the conversion away from nuclear and fossil to renewables and efficiency. They're planning our consumer future. Look at these fine print contracts we signed. They're like serfdom. You can't change anything. Credit card applications and insurance policies. They're planning our genetic future. They now have patents to thousands of gene human gene sequences, not just plants and animals. They're planning our transit future. They're commercializing education. They're everywhere. And it basically reflects the time-honored struggle in any society that wants to improve its democratic processes between civic values and commercial values. And commercial values are dominating everywhere. Everything's being commercialized, even our childhood, through commercialized marketing to kids, bypassing the parents. That has to be the central political movement of our time. And part of it is reported in bits and pieces, corporate crimes here and drug industry outrages there and people being mistreated over here by some industry, banks, fees, penalties, all that stuff. But no one has brought it together because our two-party system is so rigged that it is able to stifle aborning political party and independent candidate movements. As we have seen in our candidacy and Green Party and other candidacies. Ballot access obstructions are incredibly suppressive of democracy. There's no Western country in the world that makes it harder for people to vote and for people to have a broader choice of candidates on the ballot than the United States. One of your fellow Illinoisans, Bob, Teresa Amato, has just come out this week with what I think will be a historic book on the obstruction of competition through third-party and independent candidates by the two parties. It's called Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny by Teresa Amato. New Press is coming out with it. And this is a liberation book to try to give people more voices and choices. So issues like corporate power that we have espoused inside the political arena get a greater airing, and that, of course, involves getting a greater airing on the media. So until that happens, I want to direct your listeners' attention to a 2.5-day conference that was held a couple years ago on corporate power, and the website is tamethecorporation.org, tamethecorporation.org. And the entire conference is on that website, and you will see the most forward-thinking by the most active and involved and studious people who attended that conference about what we must do to subordinate corporate power to the sovereignty of the people as espoused in our Constitution, which starts out, we the people, not we the corporation. The word corporation doesn't even exist in the Constitution. And by beginning alternative sub-economies, like the solar economy, like the democratization of credit, organic farm movement, that begins displacing our dependence on giant multinationals who have no allegiance to our country other than to control it or abandon it to dictatorships abroad.
Our guest, Ralph Nader. This is Media Matters. We have time for a few more callers here at WILL AM 580. The phone number, 333-9455. toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Thank you. You actually answered the questions I was going to raise. I feel like I got a telepathic hookup here rather than just a phone line. But thank you very much, Ralph, for all you said today and all the things you've represented in the past. In fact, Bernie Sanders on the Tom Hartman Show this last Friday mentioned that the consideration of single payer has been tabled and is not even under consideration due to the fact that we're now, as you pointed out, in the corporate world, a political financial debacle that's been created by the derivative hedge fund tsunami, and we're paying suffering the repercussions of that now. But back to the matter of the environmental factor, which is paramount for everybody on the planet, and this matter of getting some carbon negotiations going and other things like that, and environmental disasters like impending hurricanes on the horizon with the season just starting. We need a lifesaver, and I only wish you could be back in the running, but due to the campaign financing structure now and the effects of lobbyists and corporate interests, I don't know how an independent person is going to be able to run anymore, but we sure appreciate it, and I just wanted to call up and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for those comments. Let's go to our next caller while we're on the phone lines here. Let's go to line 1, Champagne. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Good afternoon. I have just a comment that I would like you to address, if you can, is that I agree with everything you're saying and wish things could change, but in my experience, you know, the standing around the water cooler, chatting with the guys kind of thing, I'm just astonished the apathy and disinterest in getting any kind of meaningful change. You know, the characters that I'm around and work with are far, far, far more concerned about the price of gasoline and soda pop than they are the difference between the chairman and CEO of the company I work for, Super Value, that, you know, he made like $9 million last year, something like that, some, you know, 400 times what poor schmucks like me are making. And they just can't seem to be interested. It's like there's this sort of, this is my lot in life, this is what I've been given, I'm just going to quietly take what they give me, and heaven forbid that I complain because I might get fired or something like that, or face some kind of repercussion. There's just the apathy in the land that just doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. If you could address that, please. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, that's the key question, is lack of civic motivation. First of all, people are more likely to be apathetic if they feel powerless, and people feel powerless. They've been told ever since elementary school, believe, don't think. They haven't been given civic skills in high school or college, so they don't even know how to maneuver a city council process or a referendum process. So the first step is to break down this enormous problem into certain parts that people can grab hold of. And here's one. The most important branch of government is the Congress. The Congress is made up of 535 men and women, senators and representatives, who put their shoes on every day like you and I do. If we can turn around Congress, we turn around the federal government and affect the state governments appreciably. Congress has the power of the purse. It's supposed to be able to declare war. It taxes. It sets health and safety standards. It can get us single payer. It can change the tax system, tax derivatives and speculation on Wall Street before it taxes so much human labor. It can do all these things. Now, back home, people look at Congress as if it's some foreign body. There is almost no organization in each congressional district. Now, if we had 1,000 people in each congressional district decided to make turning Congress around their hobby instead of, you know, playing bridge or bird watching or whatever in their spare time, and if they spent $200 each, expended or raised $200 each to open up two offices with two full-time people representing them, and if that was done, what are we talking about here? We're talking about 500,000 people. If that was done, you wouldn't recognize how fast Congress can change, because although 1,500 or so corporations get their way now with the majority of members of Congress, they don't have a single vote. We're the ones that have a vote. So there's something that's relatively at scale. Each congressional district has about 630,000 people, men, women, children. Most everyone has a college or two colleges or community colleges. 1,000 people per district is doable. How does it get underway? We'll try to get some of these big rich guys to start a movement in that direction. People like George Soros or others, they've got billions of dollars. This is chicken feed. You can start yourself. Start with 10. Start with 10 people, your friends, neighbors. Call yourself Congress Watchdogs. Start a little website. Start summoning the members back to town meetings by proving you can turn out 300-400 people in your community. Learn that. It can be done. The students can become as seminars and classes, can have civic classes that help you in that respect as they learn by doing. So I'm just giving you one example. But if we go through every day and our main goal is just to get through the day, guess what? Getting through the day is going to be harder and harder next week, next month, next year, because we're not in charge. When people don't have a say, they're going to pay. So that's what we got to do. Start in your living rooms. Invite some people. Get organized in that fashion. There are all kinds of good manuals. How to put on a news conference. How to increase your influence over Congress. How to write an effective letter to your member of Congress that can't be ignored. I mean, there's all kinds of paperback materials, all kinds of websites. It's just got to start with a few people. And guess what? There's no major social justice movement in the world that didn't start with a few people.
Our guest, Ralph Nader. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines on WILL AM 580 right again. Line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Champaign County?
That's you.
Yes. Okay. Good afternoon. I just caught a bit of the dialogue. Be very brief. I do respect Ralph Nader for his early work many years ago in championing consumer fraud and consumer product exposés. I think that was some of the finest work that he ever did. But the comment he made to champion on public radio a book that claims this is the most repressive or worst democratic country in the world, where we two-party system
in the Western that, world.
It's senility.
No, it's actually very provable.
He needs to get off the air with that comment.
No, I'm glad you raised it so I can elaborate it.
I challenged him to stand up in the middle of Tiananmen Square, China.
We're not talking about those
caller.
Dictators.
I'll tell you what. Let's let Mr. Nader respond to your comment, okay?
You missed a key adjective. I said in the Western world. We're not talking about dictatorships. You go to Europe or Canada. It's far easier to get on the ballot. There are more political parties giving people more voices and choices. And there aren't as many obstructions to voters as there have been documented constantly, right down to not even counting them accurately in some states, and voting machine mesh-ups. So it's well documented. It isn't even close. We have the most restrictive laws against voter rights and candidate rights, and the most abuse of those laws as well. They're not enforced when they're good, of any Western country. And if you don't think that has consequences, ask yourself the following question. Why, after World War II, when we were the most powerful country in the world, the most powerful economy in the world, we did not get what the countries in Western Europe got, who we saved and were reduced to rubble in World War II in the fighting? They got universal health care, decent wages, decent pensions, paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave. They got good mass transit. They got free university education. We don't have any of that in this country for all the people. They have it for all the people, not just some workers, not just some patients, not just some students. They had it all. In other words, they went pretty far in those countries and kept their democracy. They went pretty far toward solving what John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, said productive societies should solve, which is called the economic problem. We have huge poverty in this country. 50 million people make under $10.50 an hour gross. Walmart wages, $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour. 50 million people are not under any health insurance. Many more are underinsured. And you can go on and on. So I'm glad you called, because I didn't want you to go away thinking that I was comparing all countries in the world. We're comparing Western democracies with ours.
Okay, our guest, Ralph Nader. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go to another caller right now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. And I think your last comments are right to the point in terms of really what the major problems are that we're facing. And I appreciate all your good work over the years as well. But how would you answer your critics who say that, you know, your statement about 2000 running for president, about there wasn't any difference between the two parties and therefore you were going to run, and your candidacy split the vote enough so that Bush got elected and Gore didn't, and now we, you know, and then we ended up in Iraq and all of that.
Do you think
that there are differences now in these parties, or what's your current stand on that? And I'll get off and answer. Thanks.
Thank you, caller. Ralph Nader?
What I said, which was distorted, but it's not the first person running for office had his words distorted, is that the similarities in the area of corporate power between the Democrats and Republicans tower over the dwindling differences that they're willing to fight over. I never said that they were the same on Social Security and other issues that are in the social service area. But in the central subject of who is going to run the U.S. government, it's going to be the people through their intermediaries, or is it going to be big business? The two parties have gotten closer and closer together. They both sponsored and supported corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways. They both expanded a huge bloated military budget. They both had similar foreign policies. They both supported, in return for campaign contributions, grotesquely biased tax systems and tax shelters. They both thrived over a commercialized election process, dialing for the same corporate dollars. How long do we stand for that before we get into the electoral arena and challenge it? An earlier caller commended our work in the area of consumer and other environmental areas. Well, we were shut out along with consumer and labor and environmental groups in Washington from having any impact starting about 20 years ago when the Democrats started raising big money from corporate interests. So it didn't matter who was in charge, Democrats, Republicans, we couldn't get anything done. And we were shut out. The citizen movement was shut out. Most people don't know that under Clinton Gore, there wasn't a single occupational disease prevention standard issued in 8 years. Under Clinton Gore, regardless of their knowledge on environmental matters, they didn't press a enhanced fuel efficiency requirement on the auto companies. They lost 8 years lead time on that. So they supported nuclear power. I couldn't get Gore to make a speech on solar energy in 8 years. So the idea of costing Gore the election is replied to in two ways. One, just ask Gore himself. He believed he won the election, certainly won the popular vote, won the election in Florida. It was stolen from him before, during, and after election days in well-documented manner. And Bush was not elected. He was selected by that 5-4 political decision of the Supreme Court. But more troubling in the question that was just asked is the implication that someone who got 2.8% of the vote somehow is a second-class citizen, and that Bush, who got far more votes and manipulated the process in Florida, is not the first culprit in terms of why Gore lost, other than Gore running not a very good campaign. So whenever you hear somebody say to a third-party candidate, you cost X Republican or X Democrat the election, the answer should be, why are you telling me that I'm a second-class citizen and do not have an equal right to run for electoral office like the two big guys? Because once you accept that premise, you've turned the country over into control of two parties, and you basically said they own the voters.
You know, Ralph Nader, you just hit an interesting point, I think, when you mentioned the courts and the 2000 election, because, you know, one of the traditional recourses in our constitutional system, if there is corruption in the electoral process, is that the courts ideally would rise to protect the integrity of the Constitution and stop that from taking place. But it doesn't seem like we can count on the courts to do that, can we?
No, because basically they have interpreted the Constitution in a way that allows state laws to be very repressive of competition by third-party independent candidates. They've allowed the state, you know, you run for electoral office at the federal level, you got to deal with 50 state laws. And our point, and what Teresa Amato puts in her book, Grand Delusion, is there, if you're running for member to be a member of Congress, or you're running for the White House, there should be just one federal ballot access standard. You run for state office, you can deal with the state laws, but not for federal.
Ralph, let's go to our final caller here. We've only got about a minute, minute and a half left, and let's try to squeeze one more in. Line one, Champaign, you're on the air with Ralph Nader.
Thank you. First, let me just say that it's a great honor to speak with you, but I think it's a quote attributed to Mussolini that fascism is a perfect marriage between the corporations and the state. And I've long thought that we had democratic fascism here, some form of it, but it seems less organized than it was in Europe, or less formal. And can you comment on where the power lies? Is it a perfect marriage, or is just all happening by accident, or how is this happening? It's clear to me that the corporations are in control, but can you comment?
Yes, well, we're not talking about small business when we criticize corporations. We're talking about the multinational corporations whose logos we're all familiar with, if not their products. And there is anywhere in the world where you have these large corporations, they want to get their way. And they want to get their way vis-a-vis workers, consumers, government policy. In order to do that, they have to control government. And that's what has been going on more and more intensively, decade after decade in Washington. More and more, not just 35,000 lobbyists, 8,000 political action committees, but they put their own people in government, in high government positions. They really work at it, day after day. Who's going to run this agency and this department? And we've seen that a lot, for example, in the Department of Defense. So, in answer to your question, I don't think it's a permanent state, however. I think people still have the power. First, they have to realize they have it. Second, they have to work at it. The only place where democracy comes before work is in the dictionary. And that's why I urge you to read this book by Shelley Wolin called Democracy, Inc., Princeton University Press, because he's come closer to analyzing a authoritarian pattern in this country through the corporate state, through the marriage of big government and big business with big business holding the reins.
You know, Ralph,
any
on that
political scientist I know.
Ralph Nader, on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means we have to clear out of the studio. Thank you, Ralph Nader, so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob, for all your great books on media reform, too.
Much appreciated. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha and Andrew Boyle for making this show possible. And everyone have a great week. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy skies today with a slight chance of showers, a high reaching 81 degrees. Tonight, there is a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low of 65. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms are likely and possibly severe thunderstorms with a high reaching 85 degrees.